So, we obviously are coming to the Doctrine of Man, Part 3, in Grudem's book that we're using as a guide. The question that we're on is really a question of Psalm 8, what is man? And my initial thought is all my just the way my mind works, my initial thought is always to get a sense of, like, why does this matter? And that's just how my mind begins. And I didn't have to go very far. Saturday evening, I went to, this past Saturday, I went to study at the coffee shop. I spent the first half of the day at home, and Challenge the kids went somewhere. I went to go study, and I sat outside. It was pretty, and two women came and sat at the table beside me outside, and I wasn't trying to be a meddler and get into people's business, but it was just right, you know, beside me. I couldn't help but hear. And they were having an AA meeting, and basically what it was. And so one person was the counselor, one person was the person being counseled, and she went into the trichotomy ordeal, the three parts of a person, spirit, soul, body, and just went into going off on this stuff. And then you know, later on in the conversation, described herself as an agnostic and not religious and all this. And I just, it was so difficult. It was so sad to me to hear all the things that was said to this struggling person. And they left, and the lady walked by, and it was everything I could do. Had I not just been studying 1 Peter 4, don't suffer as a troublesome meddler, I probably would have said something to her. But anyway, I was still thinking, like, I might, I don't know, but I didn't say anything to her, and they left. But that right there, what went on Saturday, right outside Tamp and Grind, from the lips of an agnostic, claiming to be anyway, was a propagation of her doctrine of man, who man is, and applying it. And so, like I said, I didn't have to go far this week. I just had to just look around. And, you know, when you do begin to dig, though, and you begin to look, you begin to see that it's related to a lot of issues. It's related to racism issues. Doctrine of Man is abortion issues. The first step in murder, in order to suppress the conscience, is to define a person as no longer a person. Whether it be Hitler or modern day abortion, racism is the same way. There's always the dehumanizing of someone. Women's and children's rights issues are related to it. Bigger doctrines, the justification for the incarnation is related to it. Why did Jesus become flesh? Evangelism is a big issue of the doctrine of man. Why do we want to go out and share the gospel with people? Why? It's because of who man is. So, if we don't know who man is, particularly if we don't know the value of a man, and we don't know the value of our children, it's going to zap the tenacity in evangelism, and zap the, what a probably, what word am I looking for? Manners, for lack of a better word, just the manners in our evangelism. Like if we're dealing with something extremely valuable, we tend to treat people differently. But you see this in Jesus's parables in Luke 15 there, where he doesn't describe, he don't tell the three parables of the lost candy wrapper and, you know, the lost tooth and the scab that I peeled off this morning. It's three items of value: the sheep, the coin, and the son. And that was his reason for why he was hanging out with sinners. And so doctrine of man has an effect there. It's related to why sin is so bad. If I sin against you or you sin against me, James says it's a strike against the image of God. It's related to the death penalty, Genesis 9. You know, there's lots of things. This relates to humongous doctrine. And one of the interesting things is that people, there's so much confusion about it, and it's almost like people are like, you know, in the position of like on The Lion King, Rafiki to come to you and say, I'm not the one who's confused. You don't even know who you are. And there is a sense in which, like, that's what the word loss means. Like, people don't know. Seems so basic, but they really don't. People walking around town today that don't know who they are, where they came from, or where they're going. And you have the effects of Darwinism and Sigmund Freud. Is just the destruction of the humanness of people. So it's a significant question. So that's what we've come to. And I want to just jump right into Genesis and go through some things there, just starting there this week. And I trust that we don't need to get into philosophy and evolution again. We went through that pretty heavy in creation. And so I'm just going to assume a lot of that stuff, the issues of truth and epistemology and all that, and just going right through that to the text of Genesis. And you want to begin there. And so I'm not sure how much everyone knows, how much commentary everyone's read, how many things. There's some wonderful things to glean. There may be some fruit you haven't picked off these trees yet. So Genesis 1 and 2, just to begin, the story is told in two parts. So you have 1-1 to 2-3 is known to be a part, and then 2-4 to 2-25 is a second version, a second part. And the way I was thinking of how would I illustrate these, and I just for myself, that I think you would call the first part, chapter 1, verse 1 all the way to 2-3, that first part of the creation story would be like the typical theatrical version of a movie. And then 2-4 to 2-25 is really the extended edition. Just think of it, literally think of a telescope where you pull something out and you pull back the folds and you see things that were compacted in the first version. And so that's the way they are. They're not telling two different stories. They're not two conflicting accounts. But there's a reason there's two of them. And so what we're going to do is start with the first one. And so the theatrical version, we'll come to the other one next week as we try to continue on unpacking what the image of God actually is. Because actually, it is never explicitly defined in either the Old or the New Testament. And ironically, it's the basis for the whole story. And so that being the case, in church history, there is all kinds of different ideas. We're going to interact with those and see what we can figure out about it. But just to start with, the theatrical version, Genesis 1, just flow through here with you. Obviously, it begins with cosmology. Verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the first thing you see here, the author is telling us, he's putting man in context of the whole universe, the whole cosmos, and in a relationship to God where he's God's possession. And so I think that's the first distinct thing of a Christian view of man, is man is a possession of God, and God owns man. And I, as I reflected about that, just try to keep this practical, it was good to think on regard to my children, my wife, my family, that they don't belong to me, really. They're not really mine. They're library books, been checked out of the library, that I have to return. Bowling shoes. They may not like me for them, the bowling shoes, but a tuxedo, a rented tuxedo, whatever. But we have to give them back. And so my reflection was, do we recommunicating that to them? Are we communicating to them, reminding them, hey, you belong to God, you know, orienting their mind that way? Or are we reminding ourselves of that, you know, when we deal with them? Like, we're not free to deal with them however we want. Paul does that, doesn't he, in Ephesians with the master over the slave. He says, hey, you have a master in heaven too. So that's the first thing. Man is a possession of God. He's not this free thing running around out there doing whatever he wants to do. God owns him. He belongs to God. And whether it's us, whether it's our family, our friend, whoever we're addressing, it's quite a thing. I mean, I've had it on my mind just for a couple of days, when you pass someone on the street, like whether or not you smile at them or not, you say hey to them or not, like it's quite a doctrine to carry with you that, like, this is one of God's things, mm-hmm. You know, how I'm not relating to it. So that's the first thought. The author here communicates to the reader. The second is, he moves from cosmology, obviously very quick, to, we could say, geology. Verse 2, he zooms right in. He's not looking at Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, nothing. He goes right into the earth. And really, all the way to verse 25, the focus is on geology. It's on the land. So I want to pose this question. Why do you think the Lord spent so much time in making the land? As you're reading through here, asking yourself, he didn't just create the land in a millisecond. There's this forming, this making. There's two verbs used here, the one for create and then the other for make. Created it and then he made it. Obviously in these 6 days, so it wasn't instantaneously, it was progressively made, step by step. And I think we get a hint of how to take it by Psalm 139, where David's talking about the preciousness of God's thoughts towards him, and he points out this illustration of how he was woven in his mother's womb. There's something about, like, the baby doesn't just poof and there it is. There was this, you almost get the feel that he has in mind, like, something handmade is the idea, you know, versus this standard thing. I thought that was a new word. My hearing must be getting bad. That's happened a couple of times. The fall. We'll get to that in a minute. I can start using that in my favor, though. But yeah, so my mom made, you know, Abram likes weight. And my mom had made one of these weighted blankets. He had one for years. You know, he liked the way it felt and he would sleep with it. And it's like a bunch of little bean bags, basically all put together. And anyway, it broke. And so she made one for Christmas or whatever. And there's a sense of, like, she made this for him, and that, like, literally what is being communicated here from verse 2 to 25 is, I mean, God is hand making the world for man, to give it to man. It's a gift to man. Really, grace, the doctrine of grace is already here in Genesis 1. Like, we didn't merit, we weren't in here. We didn't merit it. Much like a man leaving an inheritance to his kid, like, there's some things before they're even consciously able, you know, they're just given to them. Annabelle had a bracelet last night. It broke. Abram broke it on accident. I felt bad for her because she really liked it. Her step grandmother, they went to Hawaii and she bought her a little bracelet, like a flower bracelet from Hawaii. So you can't just go down to Walmart and get one. But she, I felt a rebuke in my heart from it while studying this morning after last night, because I'm not always feeling the truth being communicated here, that, like, I'm more affected by a godless worldview than I know, that, like, the flowers that grow, if we just were to walk down the sidewalk, whatever flowers you could find, like, God has given them to me. Like, not just fake flowers on a bracelet. Like, everything in creation is for man. Just given as a gift. So that's pretty incredible. We were watching a clip. I thought it was a clip, Jeremy Poe. He was showing me. I've never seen Doctor Who, and I know that makes me not able to be friends with a lot of people, but it's not on purpose. But Jaron Poe was showing me, your reaction was pretty telling, right? Jeremy Poe was showing me this clip from apparently Van Gogh. He doesn't like when I say Van Gogh, was on it, and there was this scene where they walked up to that picture and it said for whoever, Amy, yeah. And such an emotional moment for her to know that he painted that for her. And what a thing. Like, how dead are we that we don't even feel it? Like, a whole world for you. And we don't.
What a rebuke. The flowers on the sidewalk, like.
For you. Like, they're not just there, they were made for you. For man. And I just really felt like I just needed to just go, like, run my hand through some grass again or something, like a child, and, like, try to feel this again. So that's the second truth taught in the beginning of the creation story. So first of all, man's a possession of God. Second of all, God has given a possession to man. And then the third, the story obviously crowns and climaxes with the creation of man in verse 26. So it goes really from cosmology to geology to anthropology. And so we have this at the end. And again, this is amazing. I think in Reformed theology, we spend so much time trying to communicate man's sinfulness that sometimes we can lose man's specialness. Just we're complete wretches and filthy rags and nothing good. And somehow you got to keep that in balance with the dignity of man. And Paul says man is the image and glory of God. So somehow you're the glory of God. So you can't have absolutely nothing good to say about a man. Anyway, we'll get to more of that when we get to sin and the issue of it. But I think another way to put what's being said here is the author, in ending the story, the first part with man, is telling us not to marvel at cosmology or geology or botany or marine biology or whatever, but marvel at anthropology, man. In other words, like, if we look in the heavens at nighttime and marvel more at those galaxies, and then I look at my daughter and I don't marvel at that galaxy, then my thinking is off. My thinking is off. According to the way this story is told, man is the main character in the drama of redemption and creation. It's not... The cherubim ain't even in here. Like, they ain't even get a supporting role in this story. They're just not here, not even mentioned. They're watching. They're in the audience. According to Job, they're singing for joy at it, but they're not in it. And so I want to give you here in wrapping this first session up. Just the basic, there's about 8 reasons that just like arrows point to man as being the climax of creation here in this first account. Just want to mention them to you. First of all, the fact that this is the climax of the story. Like, once man is created, God rests and it's over. Denouement, the story's over, it ends, feast scene, everybody go home, curtain closes. So the fact that man is at the end of the story, then it ends. That's the first thing. The second thing, where are we at here? Second thing to mention is, did you notice, I learned this recently, in verses 6 to 8, It doesn't say, and God saw that it was good. Doesn't say it there. And one Old Testament scholar, probably the best one alive today, he says the reason it's not mentioned there is there's nothing really for man there. That's why it's not mentioned there. It's mentioned God saw that it was good when he creates the land, but just the expanse is created on day two. And so in other words, he finds built into the story structure of creation here a definition of what is good is something that is good for man. Determined by God, yes, but as good for man. That's an interesting way of just pointing toward man as being the central focus here. I mentioned the handmade way God made and gave the world to man. Another contrast here is every other time something is made, it said, let there be, let there be, let there be. When he gets to man in verse 26, he says, let us make man. And so there's a personal element here. Like the living creatures in, if you look at verse 24, let the earth bring forth living creatures. The earth doesn't bring forth man. God makes man. And so there's a distinction there. Another distinction is every other animal is said to be according to their kind. That's where Creflo Dollar uses this for the little God heresy, but it's a subtle distinction, but don't throw the baby out of the bathwater. There is a point being made here. Everything else is made according to its kind, and then man is not only like one another, but like God. Man is made according to God. And in an image, that's where Creflo Dollar goes wrong. It's an image. He's not like sexually reproduced by God. The other contrast is man is given dominion over everything. And then finally, male and female is mentioned with regard to man. When there are male and female animals, but it's not mentioned by the author. So everything this author is just ramming, like Justin's used the Star Wars, like the bending of the light, everything is bent toward man in Genesis. So if you just come to the Bible and say, what I'm just going to start in Genesis 1 and see what is this Bible about. The first thing you would go from cosmology, geology, anthropology, like zoom in. It's something about God giving an inheritance by grace, sheer kindness to this man. It's something the story is focused on, this man and the land. God has a plan to give the land to man is basically what you see in Genesis 1. In other words, bring up a quote from Lloyd-Jones. This is a big difference between the biblical view and the views in the world. Is Lloyd-Jones put this way, he said, the world has a high view of man where it should have a low view. And it has a low view where it should have a high view. And so they have a high view of man's goodness. And that's where they should have a low view. But they have a very, very low view of man's humanness. Whereas the church should have a high view. You know, you can't have very much personal significance if you just sort of morphed out of the dirt, a product of chemical reactions. I was looking up some different theories of origins. There's actually been people. There's all kinds of stuff. Meteor hit, and this happened. In an older version, there's some people that thought man came from a piece of fruit from a tree. Like, that's been a view of people. Hadn't been very fruitful. anyway, I'm about done. But the point here in what Lloyd Jones is saying, you were laughing, Tom?
Yeah.
the distinction of man is not just in the contrast. According to Genesis, the distinction of man and the specialness of man and the value of man is not just in his contrast to cosmology, geology, marine biology, botany, all the other things, but in his comparison to God. So it's not just that he's different because he's not like all of this. He's distinct and unique because he is like that. And that's what's missing. That's what's broken in the world. I think this is possibly possibly the cause for almost all the depression in the world is this one doctrine right here, that people do not have an awareness of what it means that they're made in the image of God. And so we can be afraid of telling people that, you know. I think we should tell people that. I was thinking, Justin, you had a conversation with a girl too long ago. Yeah. How did that go?
She's an atheist, and she was a longtime girlfriend of my cousin that died from a drug overdose a few years ago. And anyway, she posted on Facebook this long post about how she... it had a lot of suicidal implications. She didn't feel like she was worth anything, and the meaningless of her life. And she alluded to, like, you know, missing Evan and left here without him. So anyway, I just sent her a message and just, you know, mentioned that she's creating God's image, that she has value. She's not worthless. She's not meaningless. Just offered if she'd ever want to talk about the Christian worldview, you know, I'd be willing to talk to her about it. But she never replied to it. But, it was an opportunity where you'll see it. I mean, that's the first time I've had somebody that's friends with me. I think it happens a good bit where somebody will make a little subtle comment around us, you know, that they're buying into a worldview that they're not creating God's image.
And yeah.
Some little opportunities. But, yeah.
I was thinking, it's. I think it's harder than we realize, like, to marvel at the Grand Canyon more than the homeless guy on the corner of the street is, I would say, sinful.
I mean, yeah. It's,
that's, that will... When you work that out, like, you suddenly realize, like, that person over there that nobody cares about, like, that person's significant. Like, there's importance there, there's value there, and like, I mean, it's what I feel like when you have that spark, you're just like, I want to go talk to that guy, I want to go talk to that person, and just like the love that can come out of that. I mean. It's just really special. Like, I've had the opportunity to, like, work with homeless people and talk with them and stuff. And it's for them to just have somebody to talk to is, like, one of the biggest biggest things for them, because it just makes them feel like somebody actually is caring about me, somebody's listening to me. And it's rebuking me even now, just hearing all this. It's just like, I mean, even not even just the homeless people, but or the person that I work with at work that I don't talk to enough, you know, like, suddenly, like, there's more weightiness to, like, the people we talk to and the people we don't talk to. Like, I mean, that's not to guilt people into, like, you have to talk to everybody, like, because physically that's just not possible. But there needs to be a weightiness to that. The value of people. Suddenly the commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, becomes more significant.
Yeah.
Us worshiping the creation versus the creator. When you look at the Grand Canyon and you worship that, you're worshiping the creation versus the creation. Poor man, but really and truly to glorify God, to show you God in the creation. I mean, people that's never heard the word of God knows that there's a God. Just due to what he's created.
Yeah. That is another subtle rebuke there too. Like, because you can feel like you're this, you know, like you go on a vacation or you go and you start mingling with the lost and they have the worldview and you kind of feel like y'all are both looking at this the same way, but you're not. You know,
in some ways you are, you know.
In some ways.
I was just thinking, like, of Romans 1, like the suppression of knowing that there's a God. You know, kind of everybody knows that God exists, like based on Romans 1. So it's just for someone that, like, it's a suppression. I mean, wouldn't you take that to say if you would have someone who is not valuing themselves the right way, if they're actually suppressing the truth that they know? Would you go that far with it? Or?
You mean like someone having a low view of themselves?
Yeah, like if based on creation testifying that God exists, would that be their own self being a creation? That this view of, when somebody's depressed, is it a suppression of the truth that they really already know?
Well, it's hard, in my opinion, it's hard, in my own reflecting, looking inward at my own psychology and then watching other people and talking to them, I would say there's a conscious and an unconscious suppressing of the truth that goes on. Like, people aren't always aware that they are ramming down truth. You know, there's such a thing as confusion and deception, and but it doesn't change the fact that they are. And you may see it, you know, when you give them some truth and they push it down. But
why would you use the word suppression versus rejection?
Just like if everybody knows, well, I don't think it's.
I think he's referring to Romans 1:18.
Yeah. Don't they use the word suppress and
hold down?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm trying to think in general. I don't know if there's a big difference in what the words and from the zoom out. You know, they're both kind of trying to accomplish the same thing. But
Yeah, I'm thinking, I keep thinking of children. It's just on my mind, and we're all, you know, or there's one of us that has children, or even if someone like Jeremy Poe's interacting with our different kids, I mean, he could play a big role in that too, and Lord may give him some children one day. I think a Christian parent has an amazing opportunity to instill an inherent value you could even bring in grandparents. You know, you got Ryan and Sephora here. You think of Ella, it's like Ryan has his opportunities, however long the Lord gives him to be alive and be present with her, to instill like this value into her so that she's not as prone to search for it and other things, you know.
If I can say something to that, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
Troy has been here lately. I've noticed he's been real preoccupied with wanting to get something for, quote unquote, you know, what he says, for being good. Mm-hmm. What I've been trying to instill in him is that, you know, I love you when you're not good. You don't have to perform to get a toy. You don't have to have a good day at school for me to care about you and to love you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important, because I've been seeing that, because I've noticed it in the psychology of a four-year-old. He comes and he's like, I've had a good week at school, can I get a toy? And then one week he says, I had a bad day the other day, I'm not going to get a toy. So this idea that reward, punishment. Anyway, it was just a thought, and kind of digressed there a little bit. But so then trying to tell him, you know, just the opposite. There's times that, you know, I have to discipline him for when he does the wrong thing, but I still love him, even though I've got to discipline him.
Mm-hmm.
And it blows his mind for a four-year-old to hear that at first. He doesn't get it. So, anyway, that was just a note to him.
That's good, Tom.
Yeah, because I don't want him to. I don't want him to get tenure. Well, yeah, I'm just gonna do. I'm gonna do. I'm gonna perform or try to do the right things, because that means I'm gonna get something out of it. It's same way. I tell anybody, but that was just a thought.
I think Paul Tripp will lead you down the same road. I
need to listen to Paul Tripp. Thanks for that. Good week. I said, I'm gonna whip you, son, but you probably done something I don't know about.
That's probably something I'm going to get out of the way anyway.
Paul Tripp wouldn't approve of that. That's right.
I don't
think.
I don't think.
Oh, man. You know, speaking of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, you mentioned that. I do think that this view, this doctrine, like, I think that Christians have a tendency at times, I know for myself, to have a more evolutionary ideology of the human, like, we're just pond scum, and that's what Jesus died for, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, and there's some truth to it, because there's enmity with God, and we love darkness more than the light, so there's some truth to it, but he didn't die for cats.
Right.
You know, like, he didn't lay his knife down for the trees outside. And so, I think to hold both of these truths together, I think it'd be help us to be, I don't think you can genuinely love another human being without having this doctrine in your soul.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I don't see where it would come from. Like, how you would make a distinction between the creature of all of creation as opposed to the pinnacle of creation. How would you make a distinction? Why would I not love the Grand Canyon more than I love my own child if I don't have this view?
Oh, yeah, you can't, I mean...
There's something that we know intrinsically is different about us.
And the more that you have it on your mind, it just... You just can't just react and curse someone thinking this is the diamond of creation, right? You can't just sling it in the mud. Like, it just, that doctrine comes to bear.
It makes me sick, all the false teaching. Like, I get it, that exalts us, humanity, up as though we were deserving of the cross.
Right.
And that's sickening and repulsive, but there's something about what I said of being made in God's image that has not settled on my mind. Jacob, it ain't settled on my mind. It is not settled on my mind. I do think people can be ignorant. You were talking about people knowingly suppress it. False as false teacher, or they don't only deceive others, but they're deceived themselves. So light's coming through there, but it's not perceived rightly somehow.
Well, in Luke 15, the Pharisees didn't get it. That's why are you hanging out with these sinners? Like in his parables was like one of them was a son. I mean, we'll get into the image next time, but who has a son, you know? I mean, I saw Andrew made a post the other day, Brother Ford there, and notice the comment there was full of emotion, you know. Who has a son? Now, like, that's his point. Like, in the parable, he says, what person who lost a sheep wouldn't go find it?
Yeah.
It's like, the logic is like, why are you hanging out? Like, who wouldn't be hanging out with them?
Yeah.
If you knew who they were.
Yeah.
And then, like, what woman loses a coin? Like, who wouldn't be looking under the couch if you knew who it was? And then the son, they're like, why are you throwing this? Like, well, who wouldn't be? Like, who wouldn't be if you knew? So it's like, like, legalism apparently can't even thrive, and like a lack of, you know, this kind of like when you really are gripped by the humanness of someone, like, you get nearer to them.
Yeah.
And you want to pull them out.
Right.
You know? It becomes, it fuels gospel grief. The fallenness of man. Like, why do we care that man is lost? Because look what's lost.
Yeah. Like, we don't walk past a pig pen and grieve over the fact that pigs are in mud.
Yeah.
But it's unbecoming for a human to do that.
If Isaac was in the mud.
Yeah. Why, you won't be like,
what are
not
you?
Not living according to the dignity that God has given you.
Exactly.
Like, walk upright. Why
you want
life?
It's
the whole
evolutionary
life.
Think rightly. Yeah. So really, the irony to the whole, like, well, how do we view the sinfulness and the humanness, put them together? It's like, really and truly, the supreme irony is you can't feel the true depravity and sinfulness of man lest you start with his extreme dignity.
That's big.
You don't even know
how
sinful.
You can't even have a doctrine of depravity apart from the
dignity.
Because what other way do you have to measure?
I mean, right.
It's
yeah,
why? And obviously, why would it be wrong
for us to act a certain way?
Mm-hmm. It's like you're worth more than many sparrows.
Yeah, I had a guy come on just yesterday. He basically gave up the Christian world view. He said he's holding on to Darwin's theory. And my whole springboard was, you're made in the image of God, therefore you know certain things. You have a standard of morality within you. It's not because you were created to hold a banana just right like a monkey. It's because you were made in God's image. And so, like, I use that as a springboard just to, like, pull him out of the fog. He's just in the fog. And rejecting it.
Yeah.
I said, I would reject the God that exists, too, because you know, based upon the good and evil that God has given you, your conscience, you know God's got a gavel in his hand. I wouldn't want to have anything to do with him either if I was living the way you're living. I'd want to run back to and go crawl up in a tree and sit down. And just close my eyes and just hope I don't hear the gavel swing.
Go in the caves and let the rocks fall upon us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I heard two different worlds here, and they are. They exist. But I guess the mainstay that I see is man has a high view of himself, a very high view, and a low view of God, versus having a high view of God and a low view of man. Now, they are men that have this low view of themselves, and they're not a person of dignity or value or worth. But I find that much less the norm, I would say, because in my experience in life, man is their own God.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think I wonder what you think about that distinction Roy Jones is making, because I think, for example, if I go and mingle with some sinners down at Tamp and Grind or a coffee shop with unbiblical worldviews, they seem to vacillate in my experience between feeling really good about themselves to like feeling really worthless, back and forth. And it seems to me that what you brought up there, which is biblical, you got this like, okay, high view of self, low view of God. It seems to me that they have a high view of self in regard to their own goodness,
their morality,
a high moral view of self. But I don't know any other term to use. Tom may help me, but I'm reverting to philosophical language here. But they have a very low ontological view of man, like as a being, like what is a man,
like
what is
value,
the inherent essential ontological nature of what a human being is. That is missing.
They've got a high moral value of man, a low ontology.
Right, but a low ontological view of man. So their high view, like they don't even know what a man, so in other words, like this atheist, he's not walking around with the conviction that I'm made in the image of absolute reality, of original reality, of the creator. Like he's not walking around that view. So his worldview becomes bankrupt because his supposed goodness, where he finds all his value, eventually his personal relationships break down. I think there's some truth to what Roy Jones, that quote, I found that quote to be really helpful, that man has a high view where he should have a low view of himself, but he has a low view of himself where he should have a high view of himself. So in other words, like my friends at Tamp and Grind, you know, their ontology, their view of man as a being is similar to the dog. You know, it's just, we're all one. I'm one with the canine and the fish and the, so their view as a person, their personal view, probably be a better word than ontological, their view of themselves as a person is really not as a person, just a higher evolved primate. Rather here.
He's on the
earth. Could you mute your end, Tom?
Sorry, I'm good now.
Am I making sense to anyone else?
Here's what.
Go ahead.
That conversation I had with that guy, what I did was I mixed the two views up. So he had a high standard of morality view of himself.
Right.
He was a decent person. Okay. So much so that he's rejecting the worldview of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, so he thought himself to be pretty good.
Yeah, he was good. He wasn't that good.
Right. Okay, but he's reverting back to an ideology that is not coherent with the image of God doctrine. In other words...
Well, he's comparing himself to people versus God.
He's comparing himself to monkeys. He's saying his ancestors are monkeys and Pondstone and Stardust. And so that's where he's coming from. And because of that, he has elevated himself to have a high morality.
Yeah.
He's not that bad because he's not comparing himself with God anymore.
The image of God, his starting point is low.
Yeah. Therefore, I pointed him up to a higher starting point for him, namely the image of God, and that he knows certain things based upon his inherent dignity. He is not like a pig. Therefore, it's not becoming. He's not monkey. Therefore, it's not becoming for him to revert back to monkey theology. And so, what I did was I'm taking the image of God doctrine and saying you are valuable. You were not made to live the way that you were making. Therefore, think rightly and live rightly. And it actually exposed his immorality. By which it's totally immoral and sinful to reject God that you were made in his image of it, and to receive some guy sitting in his recliner and thought of our ancestors come from monkeys.
Like anything less than the image of God is...
So I took both of them together because I just feel like that's the best way to do it, because if I just tackled the fact that he had a high morality view, well, I don't think I could be as effective to tackle it unless I gave him a reason as to why he ought to think he ought to have a higher standard of morality, and that's based upon the image of God, which is based upon creation, Genesis.
Yeah. Behold, your God does something similar with a high view of God, a holy, righteous God.
Yes.
They start with that, and then they go to the pattern of man, essentially, who you are.
So, and I think that's key, because if you lose one, you lose the other.
They go together.
The image of God first and foremost, then you have a standard to say, well, you ought to live this way. And to not live this way is not to live in relation to who you really are, like what the purpose for which you were really designed. Like Adam was not created to, like a dog, like my dog was walking around and just eating doo-doo. Adam was not created to do that. We were just not created to do that. And I know it's
unbelievable. I think the dog would. The result of the fall, too. Poor dogs. All creation is grumbling.
I think you need to work on that example.
Give another illustration.
No, it's good. It's good.
We know that men ought not be walking around and saying and doing the things that they're doing is based upon the fact that we have been created differently than the rest of creation.
Put it this way, like in terms of Psalm 51, why was David's sin of adultery so bad? He didn't say against Bathsheba and Uriah sin, but against you and you only. Like, why was the sin of adultery so bad? Because God is not an adulterer. And why is lying so wrong? Because it's just the wrong thing to do. Like morality, no. Go back to theology again. Go back to humanity again. Lying is wrong because God tells the truth. And we've been made in his image. So we're giving, whenever I sin, I am lying about who God is to everyone around me.
Right.
So it just brings to bear amazingly on your ethics.
Wow.
weighty. There's something interesting at the if you want to look it up, the very beginning of Calvin's Institutes, he has this classic traditional thing people point to, where he says he doesn't know where human knowledge begins. Does it begin with man or does it begin with God? Because he says, on the one hand, you can't think of yourself without thinking of yourself as a creature made by God, and so you're carried right back to God when you think of yourself. But you can't start thinking about yourself without thinking of God. He has this thing there. So they go together.
It's even redemptive because we're being conformed to the image of God, the image of Christ. Christ is the exact image, the exact imprint of His nature. We're being conformed back. Like, regeneration is the beginning of God restoring the image.
We're just trying to be people. trying to work on being human.
That's it. What an amazing thought. Yeah, yeah.
That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
So the world, when they come into the church, should see, like, this is how humanity is supposed to function. At least partially. I know we're still...
Yeah, obviously.
We're still working on me.
Yeah, we ought to look... Christians ought to be the visible standard. I say standard because, like you said, there's still this fallen tendency. But for the lost, for the unbelievers, there ought to be something like, I'm not living like that. I should. I don't talk like that. I should. I don't parent like that. And I should. I don't see a standard that's just
set apart.
Totally, like, there should be a conviction even from the distinction between their life and our life, because our whole entire image is being restored through the power of Christ, and they hadn't gotten that yet. Mm-hmm. In other words, we ought to be loving people and each other significantly better than they ever could.
Like, if you were to think of it this way, like, perhaps it helps my mind anyway. Like, imagine what it would be like if Donald Trump were homeless and were on the side of the road just asking for 10 cents or we could get him. It hits you differently. Not because you believe he's different than anyone else, but you know his starting point was he was born into money, into business, into... So for him to be homeless, for him to be wretched on the side of the street, would be a great fall. Would be a great fall. And so when we see people, if we think of people being homeless, you see them, or you see them anywhere, you see them in a sin, like, it should be sad. It should be sad. Like, this is someone meant for more than this. Like, this is not what they're created to be, you know. And you see, I mentioned my friend Brandon. Some of y'all know Jeremy Poe, knows him. Like, there should just be a... He goes back and forth with suicide. He's gay. And this other day, someone came in there and made fun of him. A couple guys made fun of him. And whenever I was lost, I did that kind of stuff. I could have been just right there making fun of the gay guy. And while he was making their coffee, you know, they were making fun of him. And it's not, you know, when you begin to recover truth in your mind as a Christian, have your mind renewed and changed, you realize, like, just how terrible that is. But you see him, and, like, you just almost, it's grievous because you see two things at once. You see, like, this destruction of the human personality going on, just the devolution a man, and but you see something of value in there, something worth redeeming. I think that's what's missing. Like, we have no moral worth, but the fact that we are morally worthless does not mean we are personally worthless.
Right.
Like, that's missing.
Right.
Man is not, like, I'll go so far as to take the chance of being heretical and to say Hitler, in his sin, was precious to God.
Yeah, that's tough.
In the height of his sin, at the max of his sin,
yeah,
was precious to God. He was wicked to God too. God hated him. God also loved him.
And you see that play out in when Christ was outside of Jerusalem, saying, "You know, I wish I could just gather you under my wings, like, but you're not willing." You know, and it's significant.
Or Judas, he says, you just see him just kind of just, he calls him a friend when he come to, like, when he came to betray him, like, he just, there was grief
about it.
I'm going to wrap it up. Well, we're going to wrap up, Tom. We went into some extra innings there, but good discussion. All right, Tom. Peace out. All right.